Hi, nice to be here. I'm going to be presenting on data on speeding from the naturalistic teenage driving study. And I have no financial conflict. We instrumented the vehicles of 42 newly licensed teenage drivers with accelerometers, GPS, cameras. We tapped into the OBD port, and we followed the teenagers and the parents who drove the same vehicles for 18 months. Using these data with cameras, you're able to identify who the driver is, secondary task of the driver here, the front view and the rear view, so you know really a lot about what was going on in the vehicle. In previous analyses of these data, we have shown that adults have very low crash rates. These are the parents, and these are 3-month increments. So they are batched, and these are median incident rates for crashes and near crashes. And we have found in other research that near crashes are very similar to crashes. And because crashes are infrequent, we batch them together. You can see here that adults have very low crash rates over this period, but teenagers have high crash, near crash rates from the first months of licensure, which decline over time, but overall remain nearly 4 times higher for teens than adults. When you look at elevated G-force event rates, these are hard stops, fast starts, sharp turns, and overcorrection called yaw. You see that adults, or our parents, over the 18-month period have very low median incident rates, and that they're mostly invariable, whereas teens are much higher, and they don't vary over time, and overall over 5 times higher. In other research, we've shown that elevated G-force event rates, and here, this is a composite measure, are a very good predictor of a future crash or near crash, a near future crash or near crash. And then finally, just to sort of set the stage, I think this is a really telling slide. These are parent drivers. They're very low elevated G-force event rates. Here's teenagers driving by themselves, and here they are when they drive with their parents. So for over 18 months, it seems that teenagers can drive in a safe way, but either opt intentionally not to, or are just clueless how they're driving. So this level of risk suggests that we might want to look at other risk behavior, and speeding is an important risk behavior because it's highly prevalent. Speeding reduces the time that the driver has to react to outside events. It increases loss of control of the vehicle and is a contributor to most fatal crashes. So speeding is an important thing to look at. Our methods were that we measured speed using the GPS and the vehicle computer, and because GPS isn't always reliable, you can also get this from tapping into the OBD port. And then we compared that to posted speed limits. We actually drove around. This data was collected in the Blacksburg-Roanoke area, and we drove around and looked at the posted speed limits. So we could get two measures of speeding. One is 10 miles per hour over the speed limit per 10 miles, so that's a rate, or 10 miles per hour per over the limit per trip. And we looked at both of these measures. So you have a nice rate. If you look at higher rates of speeding, there aren't enough events, say, over 70 miles, over 20 miles an hour over the speed limit, or over 70 miles an hour at any time to really have useful analyses. But so 10 miles over the speed limit seems to be a good measure. We use random effects regression model analyses. We looked at the psychosocial predictors of rates of speeding from the baseline, and because we collected surveys over 4 times, we could look at mediation by psychosocial variables. So here's the rates of speeding again. On this axis, these are batched in 3-month intervals, so this is 18 months. And here is our event rate for 10 miles over the speed limit per 10 miles driven. And you see that the rate is actually going up over the 18 months. And similarly, you see that the rate of percent of trips, and this represents somewhere between 30 and 60% of trips, they actually went over the speed, 10 miles over the speed limit. So it's a fairly prevalent form of speeding. We looked at the correlations between the baseline variables, psychosocial variables, and our two dependent variables. You can see that the two dependent variables were highly correlated at 0.93, so we're only going to look at the first henceforth. Of our psychosocial variables, you can see the correlations for most of these, sensation-seeking, substance use, deviance, tolerance for deviance, and peer pressure susceptibility, and having risky friends. Both risky friends measured by your friends engaging in driving risk or in non-driving risk, such as substance use, are all significantly associated. Curiously, our measure of risk perception, which is commonly associated with risky behavior and risky driving, is not associated. When you do multi-level or adjusted analysis, multivariate analysis, you see that the only variable that predicted speeding in our population was having risky friends. These other measures fall out in multivariate analysis, and this should be 10 miles an hour. And then we did mediation analysis. So here we took each of the variables in our analysis and that we collected over time, and we looked at the indirect relationship. So here you have the relationship between risky friends and event rate for speeding, and you see the association that you'd expect. And then you get a negative association between risky friends and perceived risk. That is, if you have risky friends, you perceive speeding or other risky driving as not very risky. But if you have high perceived risk, you have low rates of risky driving. So that's what this relationship shows. And so we would say that the relationship between risky friends is partially mediated, and that the value of this indirect relationship is about, if you add these two coefficients, are about the same as the relationship between risky friends. So we think that, that perceived risk might be a way that risky friends influence driving. So our conclusions are that speeding prevalence increased over time. Risky friends is the best psychosocial predictor, and perceived risk mediated the relationship between risky friends and speeding. And I'd like to recognize my collaborators and thank you for your attention.
Can we take questions now?
We will take questions now.
Yes, sir.
I have two questions just for clarification purposes. The first is, you know, time since licensure is since full licensure, so the teenage drivers can drive without restrictions at all. They got their full license, right?
They're on an intermediate license, and they had some limits. Some had a limit on late night driving. They had a limit on one teen passenger for the first 6 months, and there were a couple of other limitations. So they're on a provisional but independent license.
The other question is, you know, you mean like 2 miles, 10 mph over the speed limit. How do you know the posted speed limit?
We actually drove around the area so we could compare based on the GPS data. We knew where they were, and we put in the speed limit. There are ways of getting data from on speeding if you had a broader geographic area, but we felt this was the easiest for us. Thank you. Yes, sir. Yeah. On the first, naturalistic driving now is in several generations along. There now have been a handful of studies using the VTTI technology, and then there are other naturalistic methods, drive cam, some accelerometer data. And so we, plus there's lots of naturalistic studies with fleet vehicles. For VTTI, for example, has done truck research, and so have others. Because fleet operators have known for a long time that they don't want their truck drivers to drive in a risky way. So you put the instrument in the vehicle, and by the time the driver gets back, the manager knows if they've been speeding or if they've been engaging in some kind of elevated G-force event. And what we sort of know is that there could be some, you know, effect on behavior. But if you looked at the footage, you'd be amazed at what these drivers do. It doesn't slow them down in terms of secondary tasks. We had one teenage driver who, you know, we don't get the data immediately. We get it some months later when we download it. And this girl was teaching her 10-year-old brother to drive this instrumented vehicle. That doesn't suggest to me that she was very worried about being seen. So, and did you have another? Was that your second question? Yes, sir, and then her. Hello, Gary.
Two questions. Can you describe how you recruited your teen drivers? And second, could you tell us approximately what was the cost of installing all the equipment in the cars?
The cost of installing equipment? Okay. Okay, so it's a convenient sample. We basically recruited from driver education classes, so we wanted to get them within 2 weeks of licensure. So we you know, so is this a representative sample? I don't know. We took the kids who we could get, and everyone who's done this recruiting knows that you're not everybody you approach agrees to participate. These are mostly white kids, middle. Their socioeconomic range was fairly wide. The cost of instrumenting the vehicle. Cost is a big factor. This is not cheap studies. This instrumentation is complicated. It's expensive. It takes, with the instrumentation we used, it takes about 4 hours to install. There's new technology that is quicker, and there's other technology that's a little cheaper to use, like the drive cam takes about an hour, I think, to install, and it can be done, you know, easily commercially. So the technology is getting a lot better. In fact, much of the technology that is in this vehicle was tested, supported by industry, because they're interested in this kind of technology. I predict that 10 years from now, everybody will have an accelerometer with like a light that lets them know when you've exceeded some G-force event. And so I think the technology is advancing very, very rapidly. In fact, the generation of technology we're using in our current study, where we're evaluating the effect of supervised practice driving on independent driving performance once they get licensed, is a much smaller, cheaper, meaner version of the same technology. Last question.
I'm just wondering if you saw any correlation between parent and teen driving behavior and children's behavior.
Yes, good question. We do find a relationship, and the relationship we don't find a relationship on crashes because parents just had very, very few crash near crash. But on risky driving behavior, elevated G-force event behavior, the correlation is just under 0.2. So in our analyses, we adjust for it. I haven't found it to be large enough to be sort of meaningful to suggest that teens drive like their parents, but to some extent there's a relationship. Thank you.